This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the show where every time we remind you that no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women that have done things maybe you can't even imagine for the sake of the freedom that you and I enjoy each and every day. We want to honor our veterans for their service, for the sacrifices they've made on our behalf. We want to make sure that their stories are not forgotten so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we sure learn a lot about what life was like way back when and the things that our veterans have been through. And we're going to enjoy a ride today with a Marine Corps veteran of World War II. You've heard about battles like Guadalcanal and Tarawa and Saipan and Tinian. And this young man was there for all of them. And boy, was he a young man at the time. We're going to touch on that with 87-year-old Jack Venables of Merced, California. Not too long ago, we had him heading off to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. Maybe we'll talk about that before we're done. But let's talk about the early years. You're one of four children, and all your siblings were born in Bakersfield. How did you end up being born in Tulare County down in Visalia, California?
My mother was pregnant when she and her husband, my father, went to Visalia to visit the Venables family, his father and mother. Anyway, she delivered while they were visiting there. Of course, they didn't go to hospitals in those days. She was delivered at home. I've never lived in Visalia. I went back to Bakersfield, which was a family home, and I spent most of my youth there in Bakersfield with my brother and two sisters.
And Bakersfield, I know, is where you would meet your wife of nearly 67 years. But before any of that happened, and before World War II got underway, you learned a little bit about some military history in your own family. How did you find out that your father was a World War I veteran? Because I guess you didn't know for a while, huh?
We were traveling, my brother and I, with my father and his friend, and we'd gone up into Oregon to visit his sister, my aunt. And on the way back to California, we ran out of gas, and he ran out of money to pay for any fuel. And they pulled off the road near a place called Hunter's Creek, just on the border. It's still in Oregon, but close to California. When we drove in, there were fish popping, trout just popping out of the water. So we had a good source of supply of food. Cows came by every morning, herded out to pasture by a dog. On the way home, when the dog was taking them back to the farm, he would get milk from the cow. So we had fish and we had milk and we did very well. Anyway, we went across the road, a highway, and there was a farm there. And we offered to move the farmer's irrigation pipe for him that he'd been drawing water out of a creek nearby. We said we'd be glad to move your pipe for you if we could ride your horses. So he did let us ride the horses, and we had a ball, my brother and I. We raced those horses. We ran through water. We also came to a fence, and Jim said, let's jump the horses over the fence. Needless to say, the horses stopped before we got to the fence, but we didn't.
Uh-huh. So you went flying head over heels over the fence?
Yes, we did. So that was our experience. But we took the horse by the campsite where we were. My dad said, well, let me try it, to ride the horse. So he jumped on the horse and took off. And I hadn't realized that he was familiar with horses at all or could ride. Well, it turned out that he, during World War I, was in the cavalry. He knew how to ride, and it was beautiful. That's how I learned.
Yeah, and you talk about that trip. It almost sounds like, as a boy, you probably didn't want to leave that place with fish jumping out of the water and horses to ride, and it sounded pretty adventurous, huh?
It was until we got ready to leave, and they had gone up to the highway, and there was some highway equipment, and they drained one of the tanks, put in our car, so we'd have some gas. Well, it turned out they'd gotten into the wrong tank. It was diesel. And that took care of the car, and my dad wired all over to all of his family friends trying to get some money, and he finally did get a few bucks, and we had the tank cleaned out, and off we went.
And obviously this is during the era, the vicinity of the Great Depression. I know we've been through some economic tough times in our country the last few years. But do you feel like when you talk to your grandkids, now you have a great grandbaby, do you feel like these younger generations understand what life was like during the Great Depression? Can we even fathom how different that was?
I don't think so. And I don't talk for them about it, to be honest with you. We ended up after leaving there, we went to Eureka. We lived in Eureka for quite a while. And that was the first time I'd found out that there were sand fleas. You probably never knew that. And they bite. As we were camping out on the beach and finally rented a house and stayed there for some time until my mother came to get us because we were getting pretty hungry. The grocery store had cut off. In those days, many people charged their groceries, and they kept a little book on it. And my dad hadn't paid the bill, so we had no groceries. And I was the chief cook in the family, and at that point I was making hotcakes out of flour and water, if you can believe it. We also had a friend by the name of Bob Cherry who had a bicycle, and Jim and I would invite him over to our house for lunch, and he'd bring his sack lunch with him, and all three of us would eat his lunch.
Wow.
Those are tough days, I'll tell you.
Well, and I've had so many veterans tell me that the experience of living through the Depression really kind of colored their perspective, and when they got into the war, they had a little different perspective than maybe someone today going into that situation would have had. Looking back, do you feel like you took less for granted because of what you'd been through?
I think so. I don't know how to explain it, but yeah, you become a realist.
And you would face some pretty tough situations in World War II as well, but let's talk about the way America was drawn into World War II, because everyone seems to remember that everyone who was alive on December 7th, 1941 seems to remember where he was and how he found out. How did you learn that the Japanese had attacked Pearl Harbor?
By the radio. Everything was by radio in those days, and the newspapers, of course. But we didn't have money to buy a newspaper, but we did have a radio, and that's how I heard about it. Matter of fact, I'd been in an accident and was sitting at home recuperating from the accident. I had a fractured skull and a broken arm. I had a bicycle. There's a bluff outside of Bakersfield, and about four of us guys went out there on our bicycles. And there were dares. I'll dare you to ride down the hill. Well, I took up on the dare, and I ended up in an old car body down at the bottom. And my head was, I had 19 stitches and a broken arm. That was a terrible experience.
Yeah. For being 15 years old and almost killing yourself in a bike accident, and now you find out America's at war. Did that news jolt you a little bit? Did you fathom what was going on there?
I was 14 at the time of the accident.
Okay.
So I had recuperated, and I found out about the war while sitting at the radio recuperating. And my brother had joined the Marine Corps in June of 41. He was in the Marine Corps, and he was in the 8th Marines, and his outfit was the first off the West Coast. And they headed for Samoa because they thought the Japanese were going to attack Samoa as well. Anyway, it wasn't long before I was told by the recruiting sergeant that he would be able to put me in the same outfit that my brother was in. And I said, well, I'm not quite 17. He said, don't worry about it. He said, I'll tell you where you can use as a birthplace because the Hall of Records is burned down. They can't prove or disprove your age. So I went in at age 15, as did my brother. We were 13 months apart. I was the younger one of the two. I shipped out October 19th of 1942 and headed for New Zealand.
I think this is interesting. I've had other veterans tell me that they lied about their age, or they got their parents to sign for them, or this or that. But I haven't had anyone tell me that he was able to find a loophole of a small town in Texas where the Hall of Records had burnt down. I guess there's no way to count how many people did this, but it sounds like this was a fairly common thing with that particular Marine Corps recruiter, that he pointed people to fill it out this way and you'll get in?
I think so with young people, of course, younger than legal age for the military.
And what was that town in Texas?
Farwell. And it's interesting because when I was overseas and I was in a hospital due to malaria, it's a field hospital, it was in a tent actually, and some guy was yelling, "Hey Tex, hey Tex." And it was one of the corpsmen. I didn't realize he was calling me. And until I finally turned around and realized it was he that was trying to get a hold of me. So anyway, it was kind of funny at the time.
So you'd never even set foot in Texas, and here you are listed that way. And what possessed you? I know your brother was in already, and obviously you guys had a great relationship, but 15 years old to want to go fight a war. Where did that come from?
Stupidity.
Had you known, huh?
Had I known. No, I'm kidding. I don't know why. I wanted to be with my brother, mainly. We grew up together, and we were real good friends.
And I know we're going to talk some about your brother in the course of this program, because he had quite a record of service to our country himself. But I'm sure some parents out there are thinking, man, my kid's 15. I wouldn't even dream of letting him do this. Did either your mother or father try to stop you from going in?
Well, my mother signed for me. My folks were separated and eventually divorced. So we were living with my mother at the time. We were truants from school, so I think she was kind of happy to get rid of us.
She thought it might do you some good?
Not thinking about the war and where we would be sent or anything.
So you got shipped to New Zealand, and this is not a hot war zone at the time. I imagine you were probably greeted with welcome arms, huh?
The Japanese fleet was heading south, and they thought New Zealand might be attacked. So that's why we were sent there. And when we came into the Wellington Harbor, people were hanging out the windows, waving their sheets and shirts, and everything was white. It was quite a greeting. And when we finally docked, the women had a long table, and they had donuts and coffee and tea and soft drinks. Very, very hospitable people. Real tickled to see the Marines show up. Their fellows were all sent to Africa at the time, North Africa. Well, it wasn't void of all men, but they were older men that weren't eligible to get in the military. So they were real happy to see us.
I can imagine so, and I don't want to skip over anything. Do you have any vivid memories from training or the trip over there that really stand out to you now that maybe raised your eyebrows a little bit?
It's interesting you'd ask that, because it was funny because no one knew where New Zealand was or what it was. Of course, there were a lot of young guys aboard the ship.
And you hadn't been going to school.
That's right. Well, I'd gone to two years of school, almost 2 years, not quite. And I wasn't always in school, so anyway. We had a guy that played the guitar, and he could make that sing. And so we had a lot of sing-alongs with him playing the guitar as we were aboard ship. And it's a long journey by ship, especially we were on the Matsonia, which is the Matson line. My brother shipped out on the Lorelei, which was a sister ship. We were zigzagging all the way to avoid submarine, so it took forever, it seemed like, to get there. But it was a nice journey. We were fed very well. And the people in New Zealand, as I've said before, were just very hospitable and warm people. And I'd love to go back there again.
So you're over here in New Zealand. You're still a teenage boy in the Marine Corps. How eager were you to track down your brother and find Jim out there on the other side of the world?
They were in Guadalcanal while we were in New Zealand. And I didn't see Jim until we got to Guadalcanal. And he was in the infantry, and I was in the artillery, 75 pack houses, which is about a 3-inch gun. And he came back knowing that we were there, and he came and we had a visit. And boy, it was good to see. He was healthy, had quite a beard.
Oh, speaking of, I think you have a story about beards and shaving and being pre-shaving stage. You had to fake it a little bit, didn't you?
Well, this was in boot camp when the DI, the drill instructor, came up to me, and I mean his nose is practically up to my nose, and he asked me, he said, "Have you shaved today, mister?" And I said, "No, sir, I don't have a beard." He said, "By God, you got fuzz on your face, and you'll shave every day from here on out. You got that, mister?" So I used to get up early in the morning before anybody else got down to the head, and I used to put a soap on my face and shave. Even though I had nothing to shave, it was kind of stupid.
Did any of your buddies, fellow soldiers, ever find out how young you really were?
I never told a soul. I had a real good buddy in the Marine Corps. His name was Cecil Schufelt, and he was 26, and I thought he was an old man. But he was a good friend.
For those days, he was an old man with the guys you were with over there. You mentioned getting to Guadalcanal, and the fighting had already been going there, and your brother had been involved in it, and then you come in this artillery unit. What did you see? Because I imagine you hadn't seen anything like that before, and I would imagine there are some things that got your attention. So what were those things that caught your eye and wowed you a little bit when you arrived?
When we were pulling up and getting ready to weigh anchor, I looked over the side, and I could see the island. It was beautiful. It was so green. You would never thought a war was going on there. That was a palm, coconut palm tree orchard, and a lot of undergrowth. First night on Guadalcanal was probably one of the scariest, because it was dark, and I mean when the moon's not out on Guadalcanal, it is really dark. You know, we're a bunch of raw recruits, and somebody, they had a mess hall right close there, And then somebody had hit the pots and pans, and they were banging against each other. And we thought, my God, they're attacking. So that was a thrill a minute, I'll tell you.
Yeah, I imagine you probably didn't sleep all that well that night.
Not at all. Not at all. You could see a bush out there, and you'd think somebody was there. It was kind of spooky.
There, and I'm sure with all the other battles you were involved in, there were plenty of these moments, but this is when you're still first getting baptized, so to speak, in this warfare. Were you ever finding yourself in awe of the magnitude of what was happening, the number of ships, the number of bombers or fighter planes going over, the amount of smoke and shells in the air? What do you remember about that as someone who had never experienced that before at the time?
There were two things that really stood out in Guadalcanal for me. Number one was the shelling. They had a 155 or some large, anyway, large cannon that they'd fire every night. So that was spooky. The other was Wash Machine Charlie. There'd be a plane flying over at nighttime. Every night, he'd drop a bomb and then leave. We wouldn't see him again. They had a sea battle, and they sunk a lot of our ships, and it cut off our supply line for a while, so we didn't have any food coming in. So we were eating little chocolate bars that you carried on your belt, and they were for emergencies, and they were supposed to be loaded with all kinds of proteins and whatever to keep you alive. So we were starting to eat those, and then they finally got some food on board. The Army came in, too, and that was a big help because they fed the Army very well. And Buddy and I were walking by. We hadn't been eating. We'd eaten coconuts, and we'd eaten the D-bars, and we walked by, and the guys were lined up for their breakfast, the Army. Somebody said, well, they're going to have hotcakes today. He said, oh, God, not hotcakes again. And he threw down his mess kit. And my buddy and I got in line real quick.
We'll take those hot cakes, no problem. And I know we've got a lot of ground to cover still, and this is just your first battle you were involved in. But did you find yourself scared? Were you too young and inexperienced to get scared? What was that like for a teenager in this huge battle in the Pacific?
Probably the death. There were Japanese bodies along the roads, or one road, actually. And, you know, you'd sit down and eat your whatever you're going to eat, and you're sitting right next to a dead Japanese. And, of course, they're rotting. And in retrospect, it was kind of a horrible situation. But I remember that very well. The other thing about Guadalcanal, when they were getting ready to secure the island, they sent army with mules up to the hills, and they sent us on an LCM around the other end of the island. And we had just one battery of guns. That's four guns. And a small contingent of infantry in front of us went around the island, unloaded, and there was an officer who was carrying a .45, and he was wandering off someplace, and he shot it a few times and came back screaming that he had gotten a Jap. So we thought they were very close to us. But it turns out that we were overlooking a place called Cape Esperance, and the Japanese were loading board submarines down there, and we just blasted the hell out of them. And the submarine didn't get away, and neither did the guys that were trying to board it.
Because of your 75-millimeter guns that you unloaded on them with?
Exactly.
It's time for our first break, but remember, again, as we listen to Jack Venables tell this story, when he was on Guadalcanal, engaging in that battle, experiencing all the things that he just described, he was only 16 years old. We'll try to find out more about his duties during World War II when Hometown Heroes continues next, right after this. You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 87-year-old Jack Venables of Merced, California. At the tender age of 16, he saw his first combat on Guadalcanal with the 2nd Marine Division in World War II. He was telling us a little bit about that before we stepped away, so we'll jump back into it now. You mentioned working with a unit manning 75-millimeter PAC howitzers, and there's a photo of your crew in action in the official 2nd Marine Division history book. I have that photo up on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. How many men did it take to operate those guns, and what kind of duties did you have?
At the time, I was a battery recorder on Guadalcanal, and I would take the orders during the night, usually, because we'd fire early in the morning. I would then pass the coordinates down to the gunners, and they would set their gun sights. They had two aiming stakes, and you had to line up your sights on the aiming stakes so that you could only see one. Then they could go ahead and fire. But I wasn't a gunner at that time. I was later.
What was the range on these guns?
A little over 5 miles.
So you had no idea whether you're actually hitting something until someone relays that back to you?
Not usually. We had a forward observer that would relay it back. But on this particular battle, when we were above Cape Esperance, of course, we could see what was happening.
Because you were so high up.
Exactly. Yeah.
The rest of the time, did that end up being a blessing that you couldn't see where those shells were going and how much damage they were doing?
On the canal, my brother was telling me that they had captured a Japanese, and he wanted to know where the automatic artillery was. We were firing 30 rounds a minute.
Wow.
When we were in training in the States, they had a lanyard, which is the thing that pulls the trigger, whatever you want to call it, on a gun. And we were 30 feet behind the gun in a sandbag, and the lanyard was that long. And then they'd tell us to fire, and we'd pull the lanyard, or one guy would. When we were in battle, that lanyard was about less than 2 feet long, and the guy would stand there right next to it. And we'd throw the ammunition into the breech. When in the States, you just gently put it in there.
Right.
But we couldn't fire fast enough doing it that way. Had that blown up, they would have lost quite a few of us crew members.
Sure.
We didn't have fixed ammunition. You have a shell casing, then you have the head of the ammo, and you set the timing on the head, and you use silk powder bags put in the shell casing. So each of those determines when the one on the head determines how soon it will explode, and of course the number of powder bags determines how the distance you get out of it. So it took two guys to do that. One guy at the rear of the gun to move the gun one way or the other. We had about 8 or 9 of us.
So you got your first action with one of those 75-millimeter PAC howitzer crews at Guadalcanal, and you got there at almost the midway point of a battle that raged on for 6 months. I don't know if everyone realizes that. A 6-month battle that claimed over 38,000 lives if you combine both sides. The Allies lost over 7,000 men. They lost 615 aircraft. Those are pretty staggering numbers. But the next battle for you was even bloodier. Over 1,000 Marines were killed and more than 2,000 wounded in a battle that only lasted 4 days, the battle in November 1943 for the tiny Tarawa Atoll in the Gilbert Islands. Regular listeners of Hometown Heroes may remember hearing about the main landing force there at Tarawa getting caught up on coral reefs and then having to wade through the surf at a heavy, heavy cost because of enemy fire. But you didn't come in there. You came in on the backside with your 75-millimeter group?
We are at the island right next to the main island of Tarawa. Now, that was a toll. Gilbert Islands is what they were called. And so Tarawa was the main thrust of the battle, and that's where they were dug in so well, it's unbelievable. They had built bunkers, and they were difficult. The only way we were able to get them out was with a flamethrower, for the most part, or throwing hand grenades in there.
And your brother was part of that main landing force?
I thought he was, but he had transferred. He had been in the 8th Marines when we were in New Zealand. And the 8th Marines took a real beating landing. They had a high casualty rate. But it turned out my brother had transferred into the 6th Marines, and he wasn't sent into the island until after it was secured, and they were on a team of mop-up going down the atoll. Another friend of mine and I went looking for him, and when the tide's out, you can walk between the islands, which we were doing. We had our rifles and well prepared in case we ran into some Japanese. But we would ask about the 6th Marines as we'd see different people, Have you seen them? Yeah, they just passed not long ago. And so we kept going and going, and it was hot as heck. And finally, the tide started coming in, and my buddy said, well, we got to go back, and we're not going to find him. And so we did. We started going back. No, the tide was coming in, and so pretty soon it's up to our ankles and then up to our knees. By the time we got to the island right next to Tarawa, almost, well, it was at our chest height, and we had our rifles held above our heads trying to get back to the island, and Amtrak came by with a bunch of other Marines in it. And they laughing like heck. I should say laughing like hell. That's what they were doing. And they plucked us out of the water and took us back to the main island.
And so you found out your brother wasn't around those parts anyway, so it was a good thing you got bailed out at that point. And I know when you're in the middle of something, it's probably hard to grasp the magnitude of it. But in the years since, when you have read about that battle and you see the number of casualties, you realize how bad it was for so many. Has that added to your perspective of what you were a part of there, how significant that chapter of the World War II history was?
It's interesting because before we landed, we were still aboard ship and they were bringing back casualties, all shot up. And I'll tell you, that isn't spooky. Knowing that we're going to go in, fortunately we didn't land on the main island, but there were bodies floating on the water by the time we got in. So it was terrible, really sickening.
Did you ever get used to that? Did you get desensitized, or was it always really difficult to stomach?
Always difficult to stomach.
Do you remember the first time that you lost someone that you actually were fairly close to, that it hit you pretty hard?
No, I don't remember. Well, not loss. We had injuries. We were moving up, and an Army MP told us to pull over the side of the road, and we had guys sitting on the back of the truck. It was a 10-wheel truck. And guys sitting on top in the front and so on. Fortunately, I wasn't sitting on the back because the little gun, the truck straddled a landmine, but the gun didn't, and it blew up. And it caught shrapnel, hit these guys riding in the back of the truck.
Well, I imagine that gets your attention and reminds you of how perilous your own future might be.
Yeah, it is.
And, you know, so many people, they think about the Marines in World War II, and maybe they've seen that iconic image from Iwo Jima atop Mount Suribachi, or they know the magnitude of the battle at Okinawa, and they forget about some of these battles that we're talking about, the early days at Guadalcanal, the bloody battle at Tarawa that we just discussed, and maybe two that are really overlooked are Saipan and Tinian, and they happen so close together, and they often get overshadowed, I think, by those more famous battles. And when you got to Saipan, there's a part of the island where just inland is a big airstrip, and obviously that had some strategic value for the American Marines landing there. Is that where you came aboard that island?
We crossed the airstrip. They had dumped us off near the beach. We, of course, weren't in the initial assault, being in the artillery. But, yeah, they had Japanese firing at us as we ran across the airstrip. Then when we did get our guns all lined up and set up, we were getting shelled, and they had the trees right above our guns, or right next to our guns, I should say, and the trees were quite tall, and the shells would hit the trees, and, of course, shrapnel would fly all over that place. And we had, after we'd been there a while, we had dug a large, very large foxhole, and we'd put timber across the top of it. Anyway, it would handle our gun crew, so it was pretty big. And I was on the phone when we were being shelled very badly, and everybody dove into the foxhole, and I was the last to get in there. I yelled to the guys, I'm blind, I can't see, because the shell had burst just before I got into the hole, and I'd gotten the blast that hit my eyes. I didn't get hit with any shrapnel or anything. But anyway, I told the guys I couldn't see, and the guy said, well, open your eyes. And I did, and I could see.
Those few seconds, I'm sure, felt like a week or two to you, huh?
Yeah, it did. There's one thing about Saipan. That when we were coming to Saipan, they announced the invasion in Europe. It was June the 6th. And we thought, big deal. Here we are, it's June 15th, and we're going into battle. And nobody's talking about our battles. So yeah. We're kind of jealous until realized. We found out later what a big deal it was in Europe. But we were kind of disappointed they didn't publicize our landings. In that landing, when I came ashore, there were a bunch of Marine bodies lying on the shore. And one of them looked from the rear. His face was down in the sand, and it looked like my brother. because he had a Japanese airplane band on his watch, and so did this guy. And I turned him over, and it wasn't my brother. And boy, was that a big relief, because he'd already gone in. And we got together on Saipan. He came back from the front and visited. I was off someplace, saw him and a bunch of guys around him, and he had brought a bottle of sake back with him. And they were all drinking the sake. And I told Jim later, I said, that wasn't fair. I hardly got any. You guys had almost drunk it up by the time I got there.
Back home, neither one of you would have been old enough to drink.
That's true. Yeah. That's true. What I do recall was a last thrust of the Japanese military, and they hit our gun pits. We were behind this other battery of guns, and they were sticking their tank guns right into the gun pits and blasting away at our crew members. I think that was Easy Battery. I was an F Battery, Fox Battery. And one of the guys raced back to our battery and was telling us about it. And boy, his face was white as a sheet, because he'd gotten out of the gun emplacement. And some of the guys didn't, so. And of course, we didn't know if they were going to come make it through their line of battle or not.
And I'm sure you had countless that could have been me moments, but if ever there were one, there aren't too many of you gun crews out there, and that if the tanks are coming right at them and blowing them from here to Timbuktu, that had to take your breath away a little bit to even think of that prospect, huh?
Yeah, it did. And you know, it was strange too, because we can fire the 75 PAC-Haws. There's direct fire. And apparently they didn't have time, or they didn't think about it. I don't know. Because they could have blown those tanks up, because they weren't that well built.
And so people listening understand, when you say direct fire, normally these guns are going to be aimed at an arc to lob that shell a long distance. But you could have adjusted them, pointed them right at a target, and adjust the timing on the shells so they could have taken out a tank?
Yeah, that's absolutely right.
As you go from battle to battle, and now Saipan, you've already been through Guadalcanal and Tarawa. Did you feel better prepared or more seasoned? Were you getting more confident or less confident? Because some guys say, well, hey, if they haven't got me yet, they're never going to. And some guys say, hey, it's only a matter of time. Where were you on that spectrum?
Well, scared. When they first started shelling us on Saipan, we weren't under the trees at the time. I was a gunner at the time, and I grabbed the gun sights, and the whole battery took off for the beach. We ended up in a 16-inch pit where the shell had hit, and it blew all the sand out of it. And the guys were lying that night, sleeping in that gun hole. And we could hear the firing. They were still fighting the Japanese during the night. And every once in a while, one of the spent bullets would hit the sand between one of us. And I couldn't believe it when I look back on it. No, not one of us got hit. But there was a captain in there. We didn't know this at the time, but he was drunk. And he yelled, "Follow me," and he climbed out of the hole. And he had his pack loaded with bottles of booze. And he was found the next day. He was dead. Very unfortunate. And I've told that story many times when I was in sales and working with people that I was trying to lead. I would tell them the story, and I would tell them, you know, we have a goal, and I don't want to be that captain.
When you say follow me, you want to make sure you're leading the right direction, huh?
Right, yeah.
And I don't want to gloss over anything or miss anything on Saipan, but you didn't have far to go from there to get to Tinian. And folks say, well, what good are all these little tiny islands in the Pacific? And Tinian obviously has a great strategic importance when we look back on history. That's where the Enola Gay took off and dropped the atomic bomb. Did you guys have any inkling at the time that this little island you were going to was going to hold some significance?
No, I had no idea at all. That was the first time I'd seen a B-29, but that was the largest plane I think I'd ever seen. It was just enormous. And, of course, we were concerned about guarding it, too, because the island hadn't been completely secured when they got plane there.
The Battle of Tinian ended at the start of August 1944, and a year later, a B-29 dubbed Enola Gay, of course, made history when it took off from a runway the Venables brothers and all those Marines had fought to put into Allied hands. Colonel Paul Tibbetts and the Enola Gay crew dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima, and that would be the first blow in the hastening of an end to the war in the Pacific, the surrender of the Japanese, and the avoidance of even more extreme casualties than all those countries involved had already endured. Where was Jack when all that was happening? And we'll also find out what other challenges he had to face besides those determined Japanese forces. Disease was a major problem for troops in the Pacific, and Jack's going to tell us what malaria feels like from firsthand experience. Back with the rest of Hometown Heroes right after this.
EECU reminds us of the importance of honoring our greatest generation.
Hi, I'm Paul Leffler, and there's nothing I enjoy more than honoring our hometown heroes from the greatest generation. That's why I'm so excited that Honor Flight, a nonprofit organization that flies World War II veterans to their memorial in Washington, D.C., is closing in on a very successful first year. And if that wasn't exciting enough, I'm thrilled to tell you that my friends at EECU are once again raising money to help the next round of vets make that journey.
Hurry in to EECU during the month of March to get financing as low as 2.2% APR on new and used autos. And EECU will donate $50 to Central Valley Honor Flight for every qualifying auto loan over $10,000.
In World War II, all gave some and some gave all. Let's come together and help give our veterans one more tour. With honor.
EECU. Smarter banking since 1934.
Rates subject to change. Some restrictions apply. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, when our guest today, Jack Venables, flew back to Washington, D.C. on the inaugural Central Valley Honor Flight, one of the stops was the Marine Corps Memorial at Arlington National Cemetery, where a larger-than-life statue depicting the famous flag raising atop Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi rises powerfully above this famous quote about the Marines that I'm sure you've probably heard before from Admiral Chester Nimitz when he said, "Uncommon valor was a common virtue." Jack participated in four Pacific battles with the Marines, Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Saipan, and Tinian, all after following his brother Jim's lead and enlisting at the age of just 15. Just in case you're wondering, both Jack and Jim went back and got their high school diplomas. Jack would go on to get a business degree in college while Jim became an architect. So I guess the Marine Corps and the old GI Bill worked out okay for those brothers. Jack was back recuperating in the U.S. before the war came to an end, and it wasn't because of damage from any enemy fire. It was from a dreadful mosquito-borne illness called malaria. I'm guessing it must have been pretty bad, Jack, if they had to fly all the way home from Tinian.
Actually, they took me in a LCI from Tinian back to Saipan in a hospital because I had a malaria attack. And then they flew me back to Honolulu at an Army hospital there. And then from there, we took a ship back to Seattle, Washington, Bremerton Naval Hospital.
So malaria, how many times did that afflict you?
Well, we spent, both my brother and I, spent 10 days in a hospital in Wellington, New Zealand, taking 10 cc's of the most nasty tasting stuff you'd ever want, quinine. It is terrible. And they had a little guy who used to run around the hospital every morning. Because they give it to you around the clock, every 4 hours, around the clock. They'd wake up and give it to you. Anyway, this little guy would run around, any flute today, mister, any flute today, and we'd buy fruit to chase the terrible taste of the quinine. So we finally, they gave us liberty, and I had asked the orderly if he would call our outfits and tell them where we were. And he said, yes, I will. And so I told him I had Jim's and my outfit. I saw him later, and I said, did you call? And he said, yes, I did. Well, as it turned out, we got liberty from the hospital one night. And we're down downtown Wellington, and we ran across some guys from our outfit. And they said, well, we understood that you guys had caught a banana boat and went back to the States. And they've been looking all over for you. And that's the rumor that you're gone, you left. Well, anyway, we both got, and he was up for a promotion, and so was I. And when I got back to our base in Paikakariki, the captain called me in and said, why didn't you notify me that you were in the hospital? And I said, well, I told the man in the hospital, the orderly, to call you. And then later I asked him if he did, and he said yes. And I said, that's why. And he said, well, that's a bad assumption on your part, because it was your responsibility to call. And I didn't have guts enough at that time. You know, I was kind of an awe and awe of an officer to tell him, you know, may I say something? Because I wasn't able to call, actually. I was in bed all the time. So anyway, I got bypassed for promotion, so did my brother.
And what about the physical effects of malaria? What does that do to you? Because I doubt many people listening, unless they're your age and we're in the war too in the Pacific, most people have no idea what that is like and how bad it is.
It first starts with chills, and you just can't seem to get warm. I mean, you shake all over. And that goes on for quite a while, and then you start getting a temperature, and it goes up and up and up. And I think my highest temperature is about 104 or something like that. It was terrible, and you're just miserable. So, and a lot of people die from it. I don't know if any of the guys that I worked or served with died, but it can be deathly.
I imagine it makes you pretty weak, too.
Terrible. Matter of fact, when I was standing at the checking into the hospital, I fainted. They had one of those half doors, you know, with a little counter thing on it. And I was leaning on that, and I fell down.
I don't think too many guys got to be in a hospital in World War II with his brother. Did that help to have your brother there dealing with the same thing?
Yeah, I would say it did. Yeah, misery loves company, you know.
Did you ever get him to tell you many of his stories from the things he encountered over there?
No, he would never talk about it. I can remember walking down the street of Bakersfield after we came back, and a car would backfire or something, and he'd practically jump out of his skin. He would startle him so much. He told me a story about being on Guadalcanal, and this is the only one he ever told me. They were on the front line, of course, and they had pup tents, and they'd covered up their foxhole with a poncho, and they had rifles with their sticking in the ground with the bayonet on, holding up the poncho. And his foxhole partner got up to relieve himself and came back in, and he was leaning on the hole on the butt of the rifle, getting ready to crawl in the foxhole. And Jim had awakened my brother, and he went in, and he started screaming, "I'm too young to die, I'm too young to die." And he was young, and scared the heck out of me. I think his yelling scared him more than anything else. But he never liked me to share that experience with anybody else, but he shared it with me, and I always needled him about it. I was sent to a malaria rehab center in Klamath Falls, Oregon. Jim and I met. He came up. He was stationed in San Francisco in the supply depot, and he came up to visit with me, and we spent a night together there. And then I went back to the rehab center. He went back to San Francisco. Now, to get out of the rehab center, you had to pass a tolerance test, and that was with a full pack, a rifle, a helmet, the whole shooting match, and you had to spent a week climbing the hills around Klamath Falls, Oregon. A lot of guys didn't pass it, and they had to stay there until they could. Well, I was fortunate, and then they gave me my choice of duty. Well, needless to say, I chose San Francisco, and my brother and I served there, and we were there in San Francisco when the war ended. We were both operating fork trucks at the supply depot, 100 Harrison Street, San Francisco, right below the East Bay Bridge. When it was announced the war was over, he and I got a bottle, and the cars were jammed bumper to bumper, and people going wild. When the cars stopped, and we jumped in one of the cars, and there was a couple of older ladies in the front, and it scared the heck out of them. And we told them, "We're not here to hurt you or anything. We want to get to the church." And, of course, we had a bottle in our pocket, and we staggered into the church and walked up to the preacher and asked him if he'd say a prayer, which he did. "Yeah, thanks." And thanked us, and we staggered out. We rented a flat prior to the war being over, and we rented out rooms. So they didn't have a base or anything there, so we were living on the outside, and we received subsistence pay. And they called it was at Haight and Fillmore. It became a hippie place after the war, but not while we were there. And they called our place the Haight Street Madhouse.
I'm sure there's a lot more stories there. So the war's over. You had to get back to Bakersfield because if you didn't, you wouldn't have met your wife. And I'm sure you can think back now and think about all those battles that you were in and close calls that you had. And you never would have met your wife. Your two daughters wouldn't have been born. You wouldn't have kids and grandkids. When you think back, was there one closest call that you think was the nearest you came to not coming home?
You know, that is a dilemma. I can remember being in a foxhole by myself or with somebody, and another guy's in another foxhole, and he doesn't have anybody with him, and he's yelling, "Come on over here, Jack, come on over here, Jack." And then you sit and think, now where is that shell going to hit? Is it going to hit here, or is it going to hit over in that other foxhole? And it's quite a dilemma to make a decision on which would be the safest.
And when you think about the odds of choosing right every single time, they're not always in your favor. So what do you think? You think you just kept choosing the right foxhole, or do you feel like someone was looking out for you over there? Have you thought about that before?
Yeah, I think God was looking out. for both of us, my brother and me.
Is that a sense that you had then? Did you have some confidence in that? Were you a praying man over there?
Yeah, I'll say I was. You know, there's an old story about, you know, there's non-believers until you're in a foxhole and they're shooting at you.
You want to tell me the story of how you met your wife?
We were living in Bakersfield at the time, and I had a buddy. He was a coastie. I used to give him a hard time, a shallow water sailor, I called him. His name was Bill Barker. He just recently passed away, as a matter of fact. And anyway, he and I went into the place called Good Friends Inn in Bakersfield, which was, they had a nice dance floor, a bar, and a black band that played beautiful swing music. I went in with Bill, and I looked over in the corner, and here was a girl I'd gone to high school with. The short time I was there. But I'd known her for years. Her name was Dorothy Oldfield. And the girl was sitting next to her, and she had a kind of a glow around her. She's a beautiful girl. So I went over to see Dorothy, of course, and then she introduced me to Esther, who refused to let me take her home. And they had a kind of a history of being in the place, and I had not been there before. But guys were telling me they would come in, the two of them would come in, they'd sit in the corner, and they'd order one drink, and that's all they'd have all night. Many times they didn't even finish the one drink, but they just danced their feet off. And so I asked Esther to dance, asked Dorothy to dance, too. Out of obligation, you know. But S and I didn't hit it off immediately. She was very skeptical. But Dorothy was working in my favor because she kept telling him, you're passing up a good deal. I didn't know about this at the time, but I found out later. She told me. And she finally talked her into letting me drive them home, and I did. And then it went from there, and finally we started dating. And dated for almost a year and finally got married. And wouldn't you know, the first thing that happens, we go to Berkeley, and she's pregnant. Uh-huh. We were living in a one-room rooming house, one bedroom. Mrs. Fuller was a widow, and she had rented out to several couples. There was one single guy who was studying Russian, and you had to hear him mumbling all night long trying to practice his Russian. And we had another couple that was a psych major, and he was always, when he talked with you, he'd twirl his hair with his finger. But they were real nice people. And Mrs. Fuller was very fastidious. She had signs going up the stairs to the bedrooms. Don't leave any cigarette ashes on the floor. She'd give you instructions as you're going up. And we all shared the same bathroom upstairs, which I had to go and sanitize it for Esther. She was very skeptical. But we had one baby there. I can remember we eventually moved out to Richmond into a government housing unit. And it was the end of the housing unit and had a bed in one end of the room, a kitchen in the other end of the room, and then a bathroom right behind the kitchen, which you had to back in order to be able to walk out of. It was so small. And we went through school. And I can remember the baby was where Esther used to bathe her. And she'd be lying in there, and I'd be studying and writing out term papers and that sort of thing. We didn't have a typewriter. And then before long, we moved into Berkeley. I met I was working the Hotel Shattuck part-time, trying to help expenses. We were on the GI Bill, too. I met a waitress, and boy, was she good. And we worked banquets together. And whenever there were small parties, we'd be there, just the two of us. And I'll never forget, we had in one of the beautiful rooms in the Hotel Shattuck, had just been refurbished, kind of a French decor. And she and I worked our heads off, and they had a big crowd in that little room. And they left, and we were pouring coffee and serving food and stuff, hors d'oeuvres. And a guy came back, and he said, I'm sorry, I forgot to tip you. And he handed us a dollar, and he said, is that okay? Well, what do you tell a guy? We split a dollar apiece, 50 cents apiece. Well, I did that for a while, and then I became a bellhop, and that's when I started making the tips.
And you guys will have your 67th anniversary this year?
June the 15th will be their 67th anniversary.
Seems like you have a lot to be thankful for, huh?
Mucho much.
Really quick, I know we're running short on time, but Central Valley Honor Flight. How was that experience for you to go back and see the World War II Memorial with a bunch of fellow World War II veterans?
That was the highlight, I think, of my ever being a part of the military. We were sent off by the biggest crowd I'd ever seen, with the bagpipers playing. And I couldn't believe when they had a water cannon, yeah, as we were taking off, getting ready to take off. When we got back to D.C., the airport there, I couldn't believe it. There was a big crowd there to greet us. And they had a gal who would run up and kiss you on the cheek. And then she'd run back, put more lipstick on. And then guys were running to the head, trying to get the lipstick off. Yeah. Everybody was afraid somebody would take a picture and they'd get back to their wives. They think they were playing around. But she was a sweetheart. She was having a ball. But they were clapping and screaming. And it was a wonderful experience. I had been to Washington, D.C. before with the family, but World War II Memorial had not been built.
Right.
And that is just an amazing sight. Unbelievable. I've never seen the flooring on anything that looked like it was wet when it was dry. And probably the most impressive were all the stars. Where it represented, what was it, 100 men per star?
Yeah, so it's over 4,000 stars, and it represents 405,000 Americans who didn't come home. And I imagine you could picture some of them.
Yeah. That was terrible.
And I was curious, because I can tell how fondly you felt about your brother, and I know you miss him. When you were back there with all these other vets at that World War II memorial, did you find yourself thinking about Jim?
As a matter of fact, he was on the register. I don't know who would put it on there, but and so was my name.
You're talking about when you get to the memorial, you can go to these kiosks and dial up. You can search for a name, and it'll bring up, this is the individual, and this is where he served.
Exactly. So I was pleased to see that someone had sent his name in. I wasn't even familiar with it. Somebody else sent mine, too. Matter of fact, that's how I found out about the honor flight. There was a Marine friend down in Tulare. And I never got to see him, but we'd talk on the phone a lot. Since then, since I've been back, I've been trying to find people who were served in World War II. And I've got one man, and he's down in, I think it's Tulare, that I'm encouraging him to sign up to go, because it's a beautiful trip.
What was the most memorable or meaningful element of it for you when you tell these other guys, hey, you need to go, you're in sales for a long time, what's your selling point here, what's the hook that you share with them?
Well, I it's free.
That's a big one. It wasn't the lipstick, huh?
Well, and also the fact that no, it wasn't the lipstick. Also the fact that people who are handicapped in some way or another and can't walk, the fact that the wheelchairs are below the buses, they don't even have to walk to get to the wheelchair. They have a lift at the rear of the bus. The people put them on. They go down. They bring up the wheelchair. Then they put them on the wheelchair, and down they go, and off they go. And their guardian takes care of them, pushes the wheelchair for them. It's a wonderful experience. I would encourage anybody that served should sign up for it.
Did it make you feel that somebody appreciated what you did, that what you did all those years ago meant something?
Yes, it did. Don't get me talking too much, because I'm going to get emotional.
Well, let's close with this. I mean, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us so many rich and powerful stories. When you think back on what you did, what your brother did, what your generation did, guys a lot older than you, not too many younger than you at the time if you went in at 15. What do we need to know now? What do we need to remember and recognize about what all those Americans did all those years ago?
That's a good question. It's a hard one to answer, though. I would like to think that I signed up because I'm patriotic, but that really wasn't the case. I signed up because my brother did. And I had no idea. Of course, they assured me I'd be in the same outfit, so we'd see each other. But I wouldn't give anything to pass up the opportunity I had to serve.
Is there an additional element of pride for you, besides just being a World War II veteran, but being able to wear that red hat and fly that red flag that says Semper Fidelis?
Yeah, just being alive.
Once a Marine, always a Marine, but doesn't matter if you're not alive, huh?
That's absolutely right. Now, my brother and I were very fortunate. You mentioned earlier, God was looking out for us.
Amen. And he's not done with you yet. Keep signing those other World War II veterans up for honor flight. That is Jack Venables, 87-year-old Marine Corps veteran. You'll find his smiling face if you check out the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook. We're out of time for this week's program, but I hope you'll join us again next time when we are reminded again through these stories from our veterans that our freedom is not free.